I'm not sure if that means we're... Oh, I think that does mean we're on.
Hey, I think they can hear us.
Hi, everybody. Here we all are. So, thanks for coming to this event. I'll just let you know a little bit about the shape of it, and then I'll hand things over to Chip. So, Chip's going to read for like 15 or 20 minutes. Then I'm going to ask some questions, most of which I prepared in advance, and which Chip has already told me the ones that are like stupid questions. I've scored, including the first question I was going to ask, that's scored out, which I'd even prepared a slide for. and then we're going to like open it up to all of you, and I have lots of time for you to ask questions as well. So without taking up too much space, I'll hand things over. I'm going to sit here because that's what we agreed. So I didn't hand things over to Chip, sorry.
Okay, hi there. How are you? Thank you very much. I'm going to read, at Barry's request, from a book called Through the Valley of the Nests of Spiders. And this is one of the things that's interesting about this book is the kind of reception it got. Reviews are interesting. They tell you a lot about, not necessarily about the book, but they do tell you a lot about the times we live in when the book is reviewed. This book came out in 1912? 2012. You see, and that tells you how old I am. Yes, I am 75. Okay, well, I'm going to start by reading a very small part of one rather incensed review by a young man. I say young man because the chances are he was not 75. Fair warning. This is a novel that thrives on presenting repeatedly and graphically as many sexual proclivities, both popular and alternative, as possible. Titillation is most certainly not its goal. Men are abused, beaten, raped, urinated on, defecated on, and that's about the extent one can go without quoting some truly stomach-churning incident. You could open the book at virtually any page, place a finger anywhere on a page, and highlight a minutely depicted fetish of some sort. The outrageously gratuitous sex, the sex which does nothing to further the thin contrivance of a plot, is just repetitive. Circle jerks, sharing condoms, and then drinking out of them, nude nose-picking. Incest and glory holes do not a science fiction novel make. Nude nose picking.
I know, that's great.
In a science fiction novel? What is the world coming to? That's me, not the reviewer. And also, open the book at any page. That's a challenge I couldn't resist. As a reader, as a writer, so I did it. And I'm going to read you a scene that my finger landed on. This some years ago when I first had to prepare readers' readings, this is just what I did. And I am going to read you a little bit of another scene that precedes it to make the scene make sense. Basically, let me just explain that the two characters that we will read about, Eric and his friend and lover, Shit, are two young men who work as garbage men or garbage men's helpers somewhere on the coast of Georgia. That's about all you really need to know. In the course of the novel, they stay together. They start together in 2007, and they stay together for the next 75 years. This particular scene takes place in about 2013, which is to say, when I wrote the novel, it was science fiction. Now it is parallel worlds fiction, because it's now in the past. Eric parked on the Sea Road Indian summer moved through the pickup's windows. Three cars and two trucks were parked across in the pull-off where Randall was climbing down the pole's staples. Five young people watched and joked, three black women and a Latino guy whom Eric didn't recognize at all, with no shirt, a scattering of jailhouse tats, and kind of sexy because of it, and all within 3 or 4 years of Eric's age. Below the swoop of wires and the size of a small door, a solar panel tilted toward the clouds up near the sun. High on the pole hung some kind of transformer, and above that, a light. "Damn," one of the women said, "I think we got them all up. That didn't take long." And one of the men, "That was a short 3 months. Seems like we put the first two up a couple of weeks back, but it was August when all the summer people was gawking at us." On every pole along three joining roads was a 300-watt generating panel. Eric had already grown used to them 20 feet up the 30-foot poles, leaning into the day. Randall stepped back, looking up, then around. "Well, why don't you all go to Fred's? I'll see you there." He turned and saw Eric in the truck. "You going towards the Chamber of Commerce office? I still ain't quite figured out why the foundation had to pay the company to let us install them, but we still saved a little money by it." "Hey, I'll run you over." "Good," Randall said. Then he called across his shoulder, "I'll see y'all back at Fred's later." He strode across the road, opened the passenger door, and pulled himself into the cab. "I'll see you over there, Ace." The shirtless Latino raised a hand and smiled as Randall climbed in with Eric and closed the door. "He's pretty nice looking," Eric said. "You ready?" "Sure." Randall cleared his throat. "He's cute, but he's shy." Eric started the truck. "Talk about a fast 3 months. You've been here how long? 2 years? Three?" Eric said, "I got here in July 07. "That's just over 3 years." Randall shook his head. He was a stocky black man from Arizona. "I remember the first time Dynamite called me and said he wanted to start you on the Kyle plant, and I thought he had him a black kid, because I'd heard about your daddy. I guess everybody down here did. Then you and shit walked in, and I was really surprised, but like you say, it's worked out pretty good. I was just 39 back then. Here I am, 43. But I've been kind of wondering how me and Ace are going to do with just the two of us." Again, Eric was surprised. "You guys are together?" "Mm-hmm." Randall looked around. "At least, I guess we are. We've been sleeping in the same bed, and I hardly wake up when he ain't down between my legs trying to suck me off. I don't come a lot that way, but if he don't mind, I sure don't. It feels good." "I got him at Turpin's. Fished him out of this real orgy they was having in there in the back, John, and he grinned and come on with me. But he was really enjoying all the guys at once. That's a taste I know. Only we ain't been back there again. At least I ain't. I mean, a couple of times he got himself off for most of a day, and I figured maybe somebody give him a ride up there. That's fine with me. But he always comes back wandering into my place later. Makes me feel kind of young. Now, if I could manage to get me an hour more sleep at night, it'd be perfect." Randall chuckled. "Well," Eric said, "that sounds pretty good. How old is he?" Again, Randall shrugged. 29, 31. Eric made a considering sound. "Maybe he's getting ready to settle down." Randall made one back. "Hey," Eric turned up the north road. "You two want to come around next Sunday? I'm going to be roasting some ribs. I can always put another rack on the grill. We'll have some slaw and some corn on the cob with butter. That'll give you both something to do, not to mention some food that ain't your own cooking or clams. You know, we've been eating at the lighthouse a lot. Yeah, I've seen you in there a few times. Well, hey, that's nice of you. Randall pulled his arm back through the window and joined his hands in his lap. The blue cuffs pushed up his dark forearms. You sure that'll be okay with shit and dynamite? Sure it will, Eric said. They're always curious about new guys like Ace. That's when, up ahead, under the moon to the right, Eric saw shit wandering in their direction. Well, there's shit now. Eric moved his foot from gas to brake. We can ask him. The pickup slowed. Randall sat forward and, as Eric stopped the truck, opened the door. Shit stuck his head in. Well, this is a surprise. Then pulled himself up. Hey, boss, what you doing in the truck with Eric? Come on, move over. Move over there so I can get in. He squeezed and now slammed the door. Hey, Eric, what we gonna do with this fine-looking old fella? Actually, Eric said, I just asked Randall if his young fella to drop over for ribs and corn next Sunday. The road got slightly smoother. If you and Ace aim for 1 o'clock, that'll be about when the first rat comes off the grill. Oh, hey, shit said, that sounds real nice. We can have us some good food and a good orgy too, all of us together. Eric cooks up a storm. We don't mind old farts like you and Dynamite, and it sounds like Ace don't either. Randall laughed out. Shit, do you think you could hold off on the orgy part? Ace is a little on the shy side, and that might be a bit much for him on just a first meeting. Oh, don't worry about me. Shit slid his leg off Randall's. Somehow the knee of his jeans ripped further. Eric heard it. I'll break out my company manners if you really want me to. Ahead on the left, behind a scrap of lawn, stood the rough-out timber planks of the Diamond Harbor Chamber of Commerce office. Two women from the solar panel installation crew sat on the steps. Hey, Randall said, you can let me out here. My car's around in the back. That's real nice of you, guys. Ace is probably inside. He likes that air conditioner they got in there. Next Sunday, we'll come over around 1. Good, Shit said. As the truck stopped, Randall reached over for the door. Then, after climbing out, was down on the side of the road. See you this weekend. Laughing back, Shit pulled the pickup door again. Again, the truck began to move. Here, the road was shadowed with pines. So he gonna bring that Spanish fella who'd been staying with him over? Yeah, Eric said. I think he's a little worried that Ace ain't enjoying himself while he's around here as much as he might. So I just thought I'd be neighborly. He might have some fun, get some good ribs. Enjoying himself? Both Shit's eyebrows rose. Enjoying himself is about all that scrawny jailhouse jailbird do. You remember last day off when I left you and Dynamite alone in the cabin, and I went and hitched over to a ride to Turpin's, where, as you know, I don't ever, ever go. I've seen Ace over there, too, and I had him 3 times, in the front John, in the side one, and then one just behind the rear one with 4 truckers, who I was showing the way around the place and how we do back there. You don't have to worry about me trying to start up nothing raunchy with him out at the dump come Sunday. I already had him 3 ways going. So I think I can restrict myself to ordinary social intercourse. Because I ain't got curiosity ragging me on. I already know how good he is. Shit moved over the seat and dropped a hand on Eric's thigh. He should be pretty happy with old Randall. Nigger ain't keeping him on a what you'd call a short leash. No more than you and Dynamite does me. Now, why should I even be vaguely surprised? Eric laughed. Oh, come on, you know it's just who I am. That don't mean you ain't number one. Shit's rough hand moved further over between Eric's legs. I'll bring you on down to the truck stop with me the next time, so if he's there, you can grab a taste, too. Oh, that don't bother me, Shit. You know that. Eric hauled on the wheel. I was just hoping it don't bother Randall. He's a good boss fella. On Sunday morning, just after 12:30, Eric finished grating the carrots into the stainless steel bowl he held slanted on a folded towel on the kitchen table, between the toolbox and a pile of old magazines. Beside it, on the place he'd wiped pretty clean, a cabbage sat in two halves. Eric picked up one and began to draw it back and forth over the wire half of a vegetable grater, which snowed white cabbage over the orange pile. "Shit, you want to get the mayonnaise out of the icebox? That little bowl with the aluminum foil over it is some grated onion. You want to bring that over here, too, with it?" "Sure," Shit said. "You want that celery salt, too, don't you?" "That's right." Dynamite stepped in through the side door. "Hey, I just slopped some of your vinegar and hot pepper sauce over them ribs outside on the grill. They're smelling real good." "Thanks," Eric said. I'll leave turning them to you, though." "Next time I touch them," Eric said, "they're coming off. They're pretty much done." Outside, a car grunted and growled, nearing. Shit said, "I think our company's here." "Then let's go say hello." Eric pulled off the tin foil and felt his eyes begin to water, dumped in the onions, and ran the wooden spoon back and forth over the bowl's bottom, then through the slaw. Tapping it on the edge, he turned to follow Shit and Dynamite out onto the deck to stand beside the grill. Near them, against the wall, stood a bag of charcoal. On the table next to it was a coffee can of barbecue sauce in which leaned the handle of a brush. Over the table's boards, irregular splotches of sauce made a trail from the can toward the grill. The car door of the dirty yellow Dodge opened, and Randall slid out. He had on a new plaid shirt, which made Eric aware that Dynamite was wearing a pretty spotty T-shirt under his bibs, though it had come out the dryer yesterday evening. "Hey there, Randall," Dynamite said. "Good to see you, boss." "Hey, guys, I know I'm a few minutes early, but I was sitting around by myself feeling antsy till finally I decided, hell, I'd just come on over. If I'm in the way, tell me, and I'll drive around and come back. Maybe I can run over and pick up something for you if you need it." "No, no," Eric said. "That's fine. The ribs are done. You couldn't have timed it better." "You're always welcome here, boss man," Dynamite said. "You want a beer? You boys go in there and bring some out. I know you ain't going to have none. They got lemonade for themselves. Shit made it up this morning fresh. You can have some of that if you want." "Maybe later," Randall said. "No, I'll take that beer." Shit asked, "Where's Ace? He want one too?" "No." Randall pulled in a big, loud breath. "It's just going to be me today." "Oh," Dynamite said. "I was looking forward to meeting him." Eric took a step back toward the kitchen, but because Shit did not, he hesitated. Dynamite asked, "He coming later? Sit down, boss man, right here." Dynamite dropped his hand on the back of the bench. "No," Randall said, "he's gone. Ace left yesterday. I asked him if he didn't want to stay for another few days, just to come on by and try out some of your ribs, but he said no, he wanted to get on. So I run him down to Turpin's, and I'm damned if he didn't pick up a ride in 10 minutes, just walking around the back lot and asking if the Saturday rig guys, if any of them would take him. I was going to call you and tell you not to fix for him, but it was funny. Once I got back home, I kept on thinking, maybe he'd change his mind and come on back. It was like I was expecting him to walk through the front door saying, he changed his mind." Randall shrugged. "But he didn't." "Oh," Dynamite repeated, taking longer to say it. "Well, I guess that just means there's more for us." Eric said, "I'm going in and get you that beer." He turned and walked over the deck. "Come on up and have a seat," Dynamite beckoned. "Them ribs do smell good." Randall started up the steps. You doing with that vinegar sauce? That's the kind I really like. It's what I grew up on. The rest is all ketchup and sugar. I guess that's okay, but to me, that ain't barbecue. Eric stepped into the kitchen. Out on the porch, Randall was saying, "So you guys have been together 3 years, huh? That's something. Ace said since the solar panels were all up, he was going to take off, get a ride to Florida, and spend the rest of the winter down there. I guess 3 months was all he could stand on my black ass. But I tell you, I want to miss his little warm butt up against my belly every night." Eric went to the refrigerator, vaguely aware that shit had stepped into the kitchen behind him. Eric felt a little odd that the guest of honor had not come. But since Randall was there, it probably would be okay. Eric opened the refrigerator door and stood looking into the crowded shelves. Something grappled him from behind and whispered against his ear, "Jesus!" A cage of bone constricted around him. That's what it felt like. Eric reached up and grasped Shit's forearms, locked high across his chest. Shit whispered, "Please, please, please, nigga, don't go. Don't decide you want to go to Florida or Atlanta or any place like that." Eric tried to keep his balance because Shit had raised one leg and wrapped it all around in front of him. "Hey, don't worry, I ain't. You sure?" "Yeah, I'm sure." "Really?" "Yes, I am really, really sure. Would you get the plates and take him out there with the beer and give me 5 minutes to finish up my damn coleslaw, please?" "Sure, sure. You know, I'll do anything you want. Anything you ever ask me. We'll take the beer to Dynamite and Randall and lemonade for me and you." Shit's grip loosened. "Yeah, take the glasses outside, and I'll be out with y'all in 5 minutes. Hey, I wouldn't even know what to do if you left." Shit drew in a breath like Randall's when he'd stepped from the Dodge. "I mean, what would happen?" "Well, for one thing, you wouldn't get no ribs. Come on now. Go outside and take the plates and the beer and the lemonade." "I'm going to have to come back for that." "Then get going." Eric turned to be surprised by Shit's wide green eyes, blinking rapidly, brightly. So Shit hugged him, and again was surprised by the strength of the hug Shit returned. Thank you. Well, this is the book that the reviewer said was nothing but sex on every page, which means that sometimes reviewers skip over the stuff that obviously they're not interested in.
I mean, I guess that reviewer thinks that the book is in some way shocking or something, and it reminds me of the story that you told about what's the story about Nabokov, Vladimir Nabokov and Lolita, and what he said about a shocking book?
Well, that was from an interview with Nabokov that I read in the United States when I was about 16 in Playboy magazine. I was 16 a long time ago. That was about 1958. And I don't think it really is as true today as it was back then. But Vladimir Nabokov had written a book called Lolita, which is about an adult who has an affair with a 14. Was it? She's 12. I think
she's 12.
She's 12 in the book. In the movie, in the film, they raised the age to 14. That would made it. Nabokov said, the interviewer asked him, "Well, what does it feel like to have written this shocking novel?" And Nabokov says, There's nothing shocking about Lolita. Do you want to know what the real shocking novel would be? The real shocking novel," and of course he is talking about 1958 in the United States of America, which is only a year after we integrated our school system. Before then, the schools were completely segregated in the South. But he said the real shocking novel would be a novel about an interracial marriage in which a black man and a white woman got together and they had a bunch of children and they had no problems and they raised their children and they had lots of happy grandchildren and regular children and children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Now that would be the real shocking novel. As I said, it doesn't fall with the same kind of, what would you call it, punch that it did in 1958. Mm. But the idea basically stayed with me. And I always wanted to write a book which was somewhat like that. In my case, the story in this very big, fat novel it's a story about two young gay men who meet when they are 17 and 19. Eric is 17 and Shit is 19, and they get together and they stay together for the rest, you know, for the next 75 years, and you know, and that's my shocking novel. And they do the things that many gay men do, and they have the lives that not unlike the kind of life that I had, but this is. Apparently, it worked, at least for the reviewer that I quoted from at the beginning.
I think the thing that I was interested in that maybe is that that reviewer thinks it's shocking or thinks that it's pornographic, and that a pornographic novel couldn't possibly be ethical or something, or it would be unethical in
or
some
something.
Way.
I don't know what he thinks.
But the well, okay,
I don't think he thought very much.
But the book is actually about ethics. It's about how to lead a good life.
Yes.
Eric explicitly says, "I want to lead a good life."
At one point, yes, Eric has a conversation with his mother where he says that's what he wants to do.
So how is the book about ethics? Can you share that with people, or how is it about leading a good life? What are the material conditions that Eric?
Well, being ethical is a matter of how you treat the people in front of you. Kurt Vonnegut, I once said, also back in the late 50s too, in a book that I didn't read until the 60s, he said the problem is not to love mankind, the problem is to love the people in front of you, and that's that you know, and deal with them properly, and that's I think just what it's the matter. So, and this is what Eric and Shit both do. They both try to be good people in their society. They live first on a kind of foundering tourist town, and then the town sort of lifts itself up because on an island outside, just off the coast, off the Georgia coast, and there are many such islands, an island named Gilead, becomes a thriving lesbian art colony. And they are the handymen. But first, they are the garbage men for the on the coast, and then they move out to the island, and they become two handymen who do a lot of, you know, the change light switches and what have you, and put together prefab houses, you know, for the lesbian art colony, and they, you know, and they grow to they go on, and there are this gay men who get older and older into their 60s and 70s and 80s. And 90s, and then the book, and one of them dies, and the book is over.
That's a really short summary of like the last 40 pages of the book are like really devastatingly emotional, like really I cried. Everybody I know who's read it cried. So yeah, it's a little sorry, Chip, oversharing. But so in terms of like Eric and Shit leading a good life, like I think that something that we're like super interested in, Erica, maybe, and something that happens in loads of your books, maybe all of your books, is that like big social or philosophical ideas are introduced through characters, and always like ideas are always through characters, actions and motivations or something. They're not like ideas or concepts or aren't spelled out. They're kind of like introduced through people's lives or something, and so. Eric definitely does try to, how was I going to ask this? Another way to say it, Eric specifically tries to embody a particular kind of like way of living a good life or something, and that's to do with a book that he's given by Mama Grace and reads again and again over like 40 years probably.
Somebody tells him, somebody gives him an ex-theological, transgender theological student gives him a copy of Spinoza's Ethics and says, I'll give this to you, but I'll give it to you only on one condition, and that is you read it three times. He says, I don't, you can't just read it once. You have to read it three times. And Eric says, okay, all right. And because he's interested in it. And so he does, and it's only on about the third time that it begins to make any sense to him at all. Because Spinoza's Ethics, which I have read about seven or eight times, doesn't make any sense to almost anybody who reads it on the first try, especially if they read it without, you know, without a pretty good commentary. It's that kind of a book.
Can you sum it up for us, though?
No. I wouldn't even try.
I think there's a bit in it, there's a quote I wrote down here that like sums it up in a very particular character-driven way. So like Spinoza's Ethics is maybe about like cultivating positive feelings in other people, widespread generosity, and an ever-widening kind of set of social connections. So it's about like a...
Yeah, well, it's not in that way. It does it very, very carefully, step by step by step, and that's why it's so difficult, because there isn't, you know, it starts out with a bunch of axioms and what have you, and it has axioms and scolia and propositions and what have you that all, you know, join together, and then it has. You know, comments. Then the body of the book is comments on all of these. You know that it's done by what he called the geometric method, because it works pretty well.
There's a bit where I think shit sums it up. I'll read it really badly, but do you mind if I read a
line
out of
your book? Please.
So he says, so shit is talking to Eric, and he says, and when I'm messing around with someone else, it's like you're always telling me from that book of yours that I'm fucking with another part of you, or the world, or the universe, and I guess God, because everything's part of everything else, and that's why I always get home extra horny. that's the best summation of Spinoza I've ever.
Yeah, I mean, one other thing, they have an open relationship. I have an open. I've never lived with anybody that I didn't have an open relationship with. When I lived with my wife, we had an open relationship. When I lived with my first lover of 8 years, first long-term lover of 8 years, we had an open relationship. And the last 27 years with the guy I've been living with for 27 years, we have had an open relationship. And one of the things that was mostly interesting about the relationship for me is how we had to set it up so that that would work. And in that sense, I'm interested. One of the things I'm interested in about gay society, or about the gay sociality, is how it differs from, dare I call it, heteronormative society. And I think the only thing that interests me about heteronormative society, is how it's different from most heteronormative society. At least what it is. So that's how that, you know, that's mm-hmm. that works. I think monogamy is a really strange and counterintuitive thing that doesn't work most of the time. There are some people, you know, there are some people who can make it work, you know, and more power to them. I know I couldn't. Yeah.
So do you think that like gay society seeking some sort of like inclusion within the normal laws of heterosexual society is a positive thing then?
Well, I'm one of the people who was not terribly pro gay marriage, same-sex marriage when it was first coming. I thought it was a choice that everyone should have, you know, but I thought it was also kind of a distractionary tactic from what we actually did have. And I thought what we did have was far more interesting than trying to make all gay relations look like heterosexual relations. I was interested in the differences, not in some way of making them come out to be the same.
In the book, I wondered if we could talk about like desire is a really big part of the book, and how do Shit and Eric and Dynamite, how do they desire things in the book? How does desire manifest itself in there?
I don't know. Usually they like to fuck them. That, by and large, is how it seems to work, and they like to make because they understand that they like that they agree that other people, that the people that they are most close to, can have the same feelings, and they make room for those particular feelings.
Do they ever feel guilty about any of their sexual practices, or sinful, or unnatural, or? I think
no, they don't. They don't. They don't. For one thing, they live. Dynamite and Shit have lived. Shit, at any rate, has lived almost his entire life in this area of the Georgia coast called the Dump, that was established by a gay black millionaire for gay men who he brings from all over the country. And they're brought there, and the book is about their life in this place called the Dump, or when they eventually leave the Dump to go to the lesbian art colony, where they eventually get a shack, from an old shack there to live in.
I'm really interested in the book in like how it doesn't like how a lot of great 20th century writing about sex, you were talking about like normativity there or something. A lot of 20th century writing about sex revels in like things that are taboo or something. Like it's you feel good about your your guiltiness or your sinfulness or something. But I think in the book, like in the Shit and Eric, don't feel guilty. They don't revel in like their feet.
No,
like
they're not. They're first of all, they're not doing it to hurt each other.
Yeah.
They deal with sex differently. Shit at the beginning is by far the more, the more sexually active. But Eric has, does his things too, and they're very very close to one another. Mm-hmm. They're very very close to each other. Shit cannot read or write, for instance, and he very much, he's incredibly in awe of anybody who wants to stay with him. You know, because he has all these other things where he doesn't, where he doesn't fit in to what most people would call, an ordinary thing, which is based on a guy that I know, and whom I have known actually longer than I have known my present partner, who lives in a trailer park in Dover Plains, and I've known him. In fact, I've known him before I knew either of the guys I lived with. And he tends to call me up every few weeks or months or so, and this has been going on since he was 27 and I was 35. And as I said, so it's a relationship there. And for various reasons, I think we both decided a long time ago we couldn't live with each other. But this didn't stop us from being very, good friends, and it didn't stop us from having regular sex maybe four or five times a year when we, first got started, to maybe, once every year, once every two or once a year for the last 10 years, And most recently I wrote an article about going to a sex party in New York. And then when I finished going to the sex party in New York, I went on up to see Mason and his lover, who he is married to. He is married to a man named Fred Rinaldi, I went up to see them, and whenever I go, Fred is perfectly happy to sleep in the living room chair so Mason and I can have the bed, but I don't see him a lot, but we are both warmed by the fact that, that the other one is there.
In the book, there's like a, you were just talking there, what it was making me think about was So like Schick can't read or write, but, yes. but Eric can. So there's a kind of a power dynamic there.
Yeah,
or something.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that's is that there are other power dynamics as well around race or something in
right.
between them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Mason has to have somebody who can read or write.
Mm-hmm.
And so since I don't live with him, I've been able to fulfill that time when I went, mm-hmm. from time to time, but the guy he lives with now, Fred Rinaldi, mm-hmm. can now do that, mm-hmm. for him, and they're getting along very well.
And in the book, Eric and Schick have that as well.
Schick
can't read. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that there's often in the book there are other kind of like power dynamics that play out as well, especially around like race.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yes.
A way of describing online.
Yeah, shit essentially is what we would probably the notion of race itself is a racist notion, but the point is that shit is what most people would call in the United States half black. I am probably what most people would call somewhere between a quarter and an eighth. I haven't never actually counted them because all of my ancestors that I know of, with one exception, I only know about one white ancestor. The others are all mixed race.
And they use racial language. They call each other like names that would be considered racist or something.
Yeah.
During sex.
Yeah.
Well,
and those words are forbidden. Forbidden language turns people on. I remember reading comic books. When damn was considered, you didn't find damn in comic books, and reading comic books where to make the comic book be adult, Western comic books, occasionally people would say damn and I would get an erection. That was the 1940s.
Does it still work?
No.
Damn.
Yeah. Now it requires a little more.
Oh, I had another question, but you've made me forget it.
You repressed it. You actually remember it.
Now I'm really embarrassed. Okay, well then maybe that being the case, maybe we can see if people in the audience have some questions.
See, he knows how to work these things.
I started setting that up a little while ago. I wonder if we could get the house lights up a little bit, and we could, and then people with yellow t-shirts can wander around with microphones, and we can see if there's any questions for Chip. There's one here from...
Yeah, I thought it was telling... The what you actually latched onto when you put your finger in the book at random was a scene of cooking, specifically cooking for other people. And to me, one of the things that came through in the book was actually the degree to which cooking is presented as a social service.
Yes, yeah. I think giving food to people is very important. But one of the first things that about writing science fiction, it suddenly occurred to me when I was very, very young. What do these people eat? And so I put in the food. And so pretty much in everything that I wrote, starting with the Jewels of Aptor and going on through the fall of the towers and the Einstein intersection, you will find the food, And I also, one of the things that I know is the person who controls the food is often has a lot of power in the family situation, which is one of the reasons why, mothers who do the cooking have so much of the power that they do. In just your ordinary, quote, dyadic, not dyadic or what's the other one? The extended family, before you get to servants and what have you. Although servants work into the family in strange and interesting ways as well.
There's really great soup in the Neverian books. Soups that mix together.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, thank you. Oh, those soups, yes. They're nice and thick.
Are there any other questions from the audience?
Hello, my name is Jackie.
Hi.
My question is just about Spinoza. Why?
Okay.
What made you attracted to Spinoza, and what in his work do you find interesting, what does the character find interesting?
Well, the phrase that is constantly sort of, that's quoted again, you know, Deus sivi natura, God, or in other words, the sivi is a strange kind of or. It's not just or, it's or in other words, you know. Deus, God, or in other words, nature. Now, he's not saying that God and nature are absolute synonyms, because he uses both terms, and he uses one when he means one, and he uses the other. But that aspect of nature that is seems to follow a certain kind of is a rule governed process. And he was very close to people at the beginning of the Royal Society over in London, and he had correspondence with people like Ohlendorf and what have you about this sort of thing. And he realized that the laws of nature was the laws of nature, which become science, that are synonymous with science, were very close to whatever people meant when they talked about God. And that, you know, and he followed that on through. And that's why it's such a complex construct. So there, that's about the best I can do in 35 seconds.
He also, one of his other axioms is desire is the essence of man.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree?
There's a lot in this work that's very close to a kind of Oriental, you know, dare I call Oriental, listen to me, Asian. Again, you see all the stuff that I went through that I did not shake off, but Buddhism and what things of that sort. I think he's a good philosopher. What can I say? I like what he did, that little book is worth reading, you know, a bunch of times.
At least three times.
Yeah. You know, and preferably, the one thing that makes this kind of fantasies, I don't think Eric could reach the understanding that he does without some other books on Spinoza. I mean, mm-hmm. I've read, you know, there's Bennett and some of the various other commentators on Spinoza are really almost Stuart Hampshire and people like that are really, you just have to have some help. And he does get some help at one point. One of the people that he and should take in and sort of nurse and sort of help parent is a philosophy graduate student who gives Eric a hand with the Spinoza at one particular point, because you couldn't do it just by yourself.
There was another question up at the back.
Hi. I suppose hearing kind of what people have picked up on is obviously really interesting. And the question that kind of comes to me is, like, because I feel like as that reviewer said, like, if you do pick up the book and pick any page, there's like a really hot sex scene, and I've jacked off to this book like so many times, and that just feels like it completely saturates my experience of the book. So it's just really like, I find it like really hard to imagine, and like this is like based on an actual experience, because like my kind of like white straight friend went off and bought the book because I made it sound really good, like just like in the sort of like the widest possible terms, and it just really strikes me as like, I almost feel like also because of the length of it as well, like it's this kind of like I can imagine it like quite unforgiving if you didn't have that kind of like genuine connection to like kind of getting off on it, like, because it feels like I just can't imagine like reading this in a way that like I kind of read those bits and I was like, okay, yes, he picked his nose, okay, he shares it with shit, and it's like I just find that like such a dry experience of that book, and I just can't imagine like I suppose that's my question to you, like how are you like meant to kind of experience this book without that connection to it, because I completely identify with it in that respect, like because I really enjoy it so much, almost like hearing the review. Can you understand? The review, like actually, like it kind of feels quite like personal or something. So I guess it's that thing of like maybe being like the minority audience that is kind of imagined by that reviewer that genuinely enjoys the sex scenes, and kind of how are you, how do you imagine the rest of that audience, and is it kind of possible to kind of experience the book without necessarily like enjoying those parts, because there's so many of them over the like 800 pages.
I confess I missed a lot of that.
Okay, I suppose it's just
I
imagine like people that don't genuinely enjoy the sex,
yes,
to have
yeah.
a like I feel like that completely saturates anything else in the book. If, like all those kind of bits about Spinoza and leading a good life, like it feels like such one of the biggest kind of experiences of reading it is kind of seeing something quite private put into like a mass published novel. Like I feel like identified more of like the forebears and like online erotica. Like I mean, it was quite shocking to kind of see things like lifted so directly from like things I'd read there, like about sort of homeless people and like sharing like vomit and things.
Can I ask, just to try and summarize it for Chip then, do you mean like, is it possible to enjoy the book if you're not enjoying the sex?
Is it possible to engage in a lot of the things we're talking about, like the ethical part of it and the ideas of, and like these kind of things, I talk about Spinoza, I've not got to that bit yet, but like without necessarily experience and like what is so much of the book, you know, I can't imagine just like skipping across it and be like, oh, I don't, this bit isn't
what
for me.
What do you think, Chip?
I'm okay. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll be honest. I would imagine yes, you could. One person once asked if somebody could go and prepare a guide to it that said, you know, where are the good parts, you know, i.e. the parts that didn't have to do with sex.
Yeah.
Those are the good parts.
Those are the good parts, which is an interesting way to deal with it. I don't know. I certainly have nothing. I have nothing against it having a sexual response to the sex scenes, and I think a lot of people do. What can I say? I'm very much lost in the question, and that's not your fault. That's mostly my ears, my age, so I can't really say. Maybe we should.
Maybe you could have a chat together.
Yeah,
after
maybe
the
afterwards
thing,
we can talk.
Like
because as I said, it's not your fault. It's mine. Okay.
Thank you. Cheers.
Are there any other questions? Can we do it through the mic, just so that everybody can hear it? Alex over here. And the
Hi. Sorry, I hate microphones. It's actually just what I think that last question was, maybe, which is to do with what I think is really great about the book is that it alienates straight people. And I feel like maybe that's the question that was being asked is like, about the intentionality of an audience in that book, because I guess as a writer and artist, you often get asked like, oh, but isn't that gonna alienate a lot of people? And you're like, yes, it is.
Obviously,
so,
yes, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I guess maybe that's kind of, I was just thinking about how that question
right.
might work.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I mean, yes, I suppose it's going to. It's going to alienate some people, and it's going to attract others, and I'm happy for the ones it attracts, and I'm sorry for the ones that it alienates. you know, I really am, you know.
There's a question, Nat and then Wu over here. Sorry.
Hi, I just wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about the role of the rural and it being set in a place like Georgia or in the South and how that relates maybe to some other things that are written about gay sex in cities and the difference between the rural and maybe why you're interested in that as opposed to writing about, of course,
well,
you've
this
written
is a, this is
too,
very much a Georgia of the mind. It's geographically, it is a real Georgia. I actually had a woman friend came and actually wrote some descriptions of some places in Georgia that I used her, I used them as the basis of some descriptions of mine. A writer named Cheshire Burke. I've given an acknowledgement in the front or in the back of the book. I think that's where the acknowledgements are, in the back. But by and large, it is very much a Georgia of the mind. I hitchhiked through Georgia once, and some of the things that I saw and what have you as I remember them. That was a long time ago, but I remember them enough to have something about them, and that's how that works.
Is there a difference between a rural sexuality and an urban sexuality then, do you think?
I think there. Guess there's some. I don't know. I mean, it happens. There is a very high concentration of urban black gay men in this one area that have been moved there by this guy named Robert Kyle III. And he is, you know, he's moved them there, and they are all living there, and they have brought with them the kinds of things that are done by urban black men and some rural black men as well. And there are some conservative people who come down, and there's one scene that I thought was very funny, and at least one or two other people have said they thought it was funny too. So I take that as a compliment. That happen in the, you know, in the local John in the dump, and things of that sort. So, you know, that's the way that goes. It's gotten some, you know, it's not all reviews were like this one, the one I read you. Some of them are almost as good as this one is, incensed and unhappy.
Another question.
Hi. So this is kind of building on the long question at the back and the comment Linda made in the front. I think it was Linda. I can't see across the room. But I'm very interested. I would love to hear more about what other queer writers you've kind of feel like you've been in conversation with or who've inspired you over the decades, like, because you've been writing for such a substantially long period of time. And I think this question about the erotics of the text, of the sexuality, is so pivotal to queer writing. Mm-hmm. And like the sexuality that's like that so many queer novels and so much queer text is like brimming and exploding with, it's so key to why that literature becomes so important to us. And I think about that as specifically like a queer aesthetic or a queer textuality.
Well,
or something.
The book is in conversation with a lot of things. It's in the title, and a running thing is that it's in conversation with is Peter Jackson's King Kong, the Valley of the Nest of Spiders is the omitted scene that Peter Jackson reproduces, both in two forms. One, he makes a version of it that can be edited in to the original King Kong that looks like it, you know, and that's a real tour de force. I hope some of you have seen it. And then he makes his own version of King Kong, where he has that scene also, but it's blown up and it's inflated, and all the encounters with the dinosaurs and what have you are just exploded into total camp. You know, and then they are, and I think they are hysterically funny. And I think they were intended to be hysterically funny. Somebody cannot fall out of a tree in that film. It takes them 12 minutes to fall through the branches of a tree while two dinosaurs go swinging at them on vines and so forth and so on. I think it's a great film. I do. I really do. And people think I'm nuts. You know.
Nat was also asking about like the other queer writers that you've maybe in dialogue with over your career.
Okay, yeah. There are lots of Guy Davenport is one of the writers that I you know. Spinoza is another one. Spinoza's everything about Spinoza other than his philosophy was destroyed by his followers. Why? You know, probably because he was gay. You know. I think there's a real possibility that that was the reason, you know, that he had to, that he went to live in The Hague and what have you, out of the, you know. And he died very young. He died, I think, in his 40s, which is, you know, which is also a little strange. I've got a novella directly about Spinoza that is be my next long story. It's somewhere between a long story called The Atheist in the Attic, which will be out by the end of this year, at the end of this year, maybe the next February, I think it's due to come out. And it's a reconstruction of a meeting between Leibniz and Spinoza in The Hague in 1674 or 75. I don't remember when that actually took place. But they spent three afternoons together, and it's the first of the three afternoons that they spent together because nobody knows what they talked about. So you can pretty much guess anything you want. And there you go.
What about Guy Davenport? He writes kind of like a gay utopian kind of.
Yeah, yes, sometime. he does. Mm-hmm. And White's beautiful. It's one of the stylistically most letter perfect writers, and his stuff is researched up the wazoo, and he's just a beautiful one of the I think he's one of the great American writers of the middle of the last century, and he's mostly wrote short fiction, and basically his work consists of about 66 gem-like stories and some artwork that he also was a painter, and between the painting and the art, and it's very, very homoerotic, and it's also but not exclusively so. There are some female nudes that work their way in. And he's good stuff. What can you say?
Was that another question? Wu had a question.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot since yesterday about something you said about your commitment to truth or accuracy when you're writing, which seems to me to be a kind of ethics in what you're doing, or even maybe like a queerness. There's something like a queer sexuality of specificity. And I was wondering, it also made me think about a very moving story that you told at Bard last summer about getting in a fight with a friend that was Greek about like getting it wrong.
Oh, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it just seems like this deep level of investment you have in accuracy. And I was wondering if you could talk about how does that work when you're imagining worlds, like really otherworldly worlds? Like how does accuracy come to you?
Well, you imagine them, and you imagine, well, what would it really be like? You know, what would it actually be like? That's, that's what you do. in Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders, which I think of as a science fiction novel, and it's a very long novel, and it slides very, very slowly into the science fiction. Many people don't even see the changes that go into the first couple of hundred pages. There are nanotechnology wrenches at some point, where I've thought about how they would, what you could do with them and what you couldn't do. A lot of the things is what you can't do with the technology, which is a lot of science fiction writers don't worry about. The technology is that with which you can do anything, and I don't like that. You know.
So it's almost like finding the limits.
Pardon me? Yeah. It's all about limits. Yeah. We have a hand down here.
Up here.
Go on.
At the back.
So kind of asking again about Georgia, and particularly the islands off the coast of Georgia in the south, which have historically had hosted communities that are escaped slave communities, free black communities.
Yeah.
Off the coast of Georgia was one of the first, Muslim communities in the United States.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. thinking about what you were talking about heteronormativity and Foucault in A Friendship as a Way of Life talks about his homosexuality is an historic occasion to reopen affective ritualities that allow the homosexual figure to move through society on diagonal lines. And thinking about kind of those two ideas of these islands off the coast of this colonial settler society as these sites of freedom, but then also those historic occasions. And I think particularly I'm curious thinking about what you were just addressing of this, you're writing about another timeline into the future. And so what does it mean to as Foucault says, reopen affective virtualities, but find new ones in the future to open for the first time, perhaps?
Yeah. Most of my stuff is not anything new opening up. At least, and certainly not in this particular book. There are some of the earlier works. The earlier works move very slowly towards dealing with an interstellar society, and then it went back again. And with a book called Dahlgren, I backtracked and let's talk about the world. Let's stay closer to the world that is the case. Which is a quote from Wittgenstein, which is the beginning of a quote from the Tractatus. It is the world that is the case, and it is. And at a certain point, as you become more concerned about philosophy, you become more concerned about commenting on the world that is the case, you're doing it all over again in here. The new stuff doesn't open up quite in that way. It opens up much more slowly. So you spiral around. Now, one of my stories is called Time's Considered as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stone. It's not a circle, but it goes, around and around again. And I think that's the way, it tends to go.
And there's that great quote that we really love about science fiction being a significant distortion of the present.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh. And you distort it less and less. One thing that I think was very, one of the things that makes it science fiction that one somebody noticed and actually wrote about this is where at one point Eric goes to pay their taxes. Anyway, what, he doesn't do it online? No, he doesn't. that's my error. He actually goes to an office and hands in his tax forms. Pretty late in the book. And that's probably, I had a lot of problems with my taxes over here, and that's reflecting that.
Whereas in some of your earlier books, there are things that the general intellect in Stars in My Pockets, Grains of Sand, predicts the internet in a way that's an internet that's accessible straight to your, mm-hmm. you just have to think of a question.
Right. People like that. that's the kind of thing that people like, and I think I don't know whether we're going to have the luxury of that at this point.
Is there any other questions? Let's see. There's one all the way over here. Oh, and there was this one at the front first.
I'm thinking about the bugs from yesterday.
Pardon me?
The bugs yesterday.
Yes.
The Guardian article. And this last question kind of clouded things. Let me reground. So the bugs, this 25% reduction in the biomass of bugs.
Yes.
That's like this unimaginable thing,
right,
that has been made
real. Nobody predicted that. Yes, right.
So I'm thinking about what are the implications of when the unimaginable becomes made manifest for how one locates these other worlds that already exist in a.
Well, I think the thing is to stop. I think one of my beefs, I suppose, with the name of the conference here, this notion of other worlds. We do not have other worlds. We got one. You know, and what other worlds as a metaphor, I think, is great, but we've got to remember that the world is physically a very large place, and when you start reducing by 25%, you know, the biomass of all, you know, bugs in Germany and bugs in America and bugs in, you know, in Asia and bugs in, you know, Australia. I know they have tested for this in both Germany and England. I don't know how, you know, I assume that it's pretty universal. That's really scary. That just is very, very scary. Well, a lot of things are turning out to be worldwide. You know, the octopi are walking around on beaches at this point. That's another thing that's going on, because they don't like the water. You know, something is kind of driving them out of the water. We don't know and how that's going to work. Every once in a while there are weird things that don't happen, like in my country. I cannot understand why there isn't a serious move to get rid of the Electoral College. You know, that's just insane. You know, given the way the vote went last time, that is just nuts.
Do you mean that like the Electoral College is a kind of science fiction?
No, it's stupid. No, it's stupid and it's dangerous. You know, if we didn't have the Electoral College, Trump would not be president. It's as simple as that. He lost, but you know, he lost by the largest popular majority ever. You know, not just a few thousand votes, or you know, he lost by a couple of million votes. That's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous. That's the kind of thing.
The next question was over here.
Oh, hi. I wanted to pick up on some of the questions about influences of other writers and link it to some of the discussion yesterday, particularly in regards to New York. So I was interested in maybe your relationship to another black writer who came into mind during the discussion yesterday, Amiri Baraka.
Yes.
Kind of like black writer in New York, in Greenwich Village. Whether you had a personal relationship with him, but also your relationship to his writing and his work.
I like his work, certainly. There's one of his poems called Patmos, which is the title taken from a Hölderlin poem, which I want to write something on it. I've been making little stabs. We had a connection through the Naropa Summer Writing Program, where I taught for 17 years in the summers. 1 week each summer, and he taught there sometimes. So a couple of times we overlapped. So we have talked to each other and shaken hands before he died. I think he was an important writer. And I read, you know, I started reading him very early. I mean, I started reading him with the tales and a long time ago. And his plays, The Toilet, and what some of the others, The Dutchman, and things of that sort. So I thought he was a very important writer.
In Dark Reflections, there's a scene where the main character sees Baraka in
a church.
I get the impression that actually you saw him in the same scene.
Yes, that's a very autobiographical scene. There's an account on the actual date, that it's actually dated the date that he gave the reading at St. Mark's Place, where he came in with a bunch of people from New Jersey, firing off blank guns in the basement of St. Mark's Church. One of the things I did is I bit the inside of my cheek to blood. That actually happens in the book. It scared the shit out of me. But I also, the guy to whom it happens in the book is a very conservative guy. And he doesn't like it at all. He's very upset by the whole thing. I thought it was a great reading, you know. So in that sense, I'm very different from the actual narrator. And there is always this difference between, you know, the narrator of any story and the reality, even when it's based on reality. So, yeah.
Are there any other questions? There's one down the front here, I think.
Hi. I was wondering what's the relationship between the kind of more obviously sci-fi elements in your books and the, I don't know, the social and the sex and so on. Like, are they part of an integrated whole, or are they different threads that run through?
Different, you know, threads. That's right. The answer.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, go on. I mean,
yeah, like, I don't know what's. I mean, I haven't, without knowing anything prior to this weekend, I haven't had much of a window into the sci-fi elements of your work. Now you mentioned that there's nanotechnologies and so on, but like, so what motivates the I don't know, the building of those worlds versus, you know, the social worlds and so on?
Yeah, well, yes, I guess is the answer. No, seriously, I mean, I think as far as I can respond to it, I think they are different things. The threads do not all get, every once in a while some of them get tied up, but there are three novels called The Fall of the Towers, which were three short novels, and that's there's an attempt to tie things up, though that was a very young work, and what somebody once said, it's an epic, and one said young immature writers just fall in love with epics, and I was a young immature writer, and so I fell in love with the epic just like we do, and I stopped. That's not an epic. That's much bigger and much more particular.
If I can follow up once more. But I wonder, is there some element in like an otherwise in terms of the social situation? I mean, it seems to me maybe the kind of gay world that your characters live in is, is it like certain problems are solved or?
What was the last sentence?
Are certain
just repeat it. Yeah.
Is it that certain problems are solved?
No, they don't know. Nobody ever nobody ever solves all their problems. I don't think that's what people do. You have periods where things are working out better than others, yeah, and some where they're not.
Like in this book, even though they move into a future where they, in some senses, live in a utopian space on the island, there's still nuclear war and like kind of willful stupidity, and still struggle continues.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Maybe got time for one last question. Are there any other questions? One question here, right at the front in the middle.
This is also kind of about utopian spaces and the notion of, I suppose, ways of living together in closed communities that aren't the private family or couple. So in this book is an example. And you write about your own experience at summer camp. And I wonder if I'm like deeply interested in summer camp as this kind of like strange utopian communal space that certainly in the US, many children go through, and I'd love to know if you've ever connected that experience to some of these like utopian communal spaces that you write about in your fiction.
Absolutely. I the summer camps for me, my first summer camp was a nightmare. And my second summer camp was most wonderful. I still think it was some of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me. There's a book that has been written by it, by a kid who was in my bunk named Peter Horn, called The Improbable Community. I think it's a book with some big failures. The biggest failure, although I'm glad that somebody has written something about it, it's about the administration of the camp. And what it isn't about is the campers, because the campers were what were wonderful. The campers and the counselors were what were wonderful about the camp, and the fact that the administration was wonderful to the extent that they wanted something like this to happen. But in the book, there are pictures. There's a picture of me on page 104 as a kid playing a guitar at a Catskill Folk Festival, there at the same time, there's no identification of me. Me and my sister, who went to the same camp, said, "Chip, that's you," But nobody is identified, and it should be. A lot of interesting people went to that camp. Robert De Niro went to that camp, and he is an interesting guy. And he's not just a good actor, but he's also somebody with principles, and the principles go directly back to the kinds of things that were going on in the camp. Lorraine Hansberry's husband, the playwright Lorraine Hansberry's husband, also went, and his brother also went to the camp, things like that. The term, I think, is red diaper baby camp. We were red. I was a red diaper baby. And that had a lot to do with.
What does that mean? Sorry, red diaper baby.
It means your family is squarely on the left. It's red as in communist is what is what it means. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe on the communist sanitary wear. It's a good place to stop. We're running out of time, so I just say thanks for all of your questions and thanks to Chip for the reading.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I think that wasn't that bad. You did fine.
You did fine. Yeah, thank you. I thought the reading was great. I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Yeah, you're a really great reader.
Thank you.
Yeah, and there were loads of interesting questions.
Yeah, I thought that. I'm not. The combination. I think my ears are going. My hearing is, and the accent is not doesn't make it easier.
Maybe I can see if he wants to have a wee chat to you.
Sure. Yeah. No. Because I had no. I was missing every other word the guy was saying.
He sort of repeated himself a lot, so it was a very meandering question.
Yeah. Exactly. And
it was mostly around. Can you? I think he was maybe took issue with the fact that we weren't talking about the pornographic content enough. Gay, you might not
Right.
Could you be straight and get something out of the book?
To which I hope the answer is yeah. If he had said that, I would have said I hope so, and some straight people do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can grab a hold of it. That would be good.
Is he still up there? No, he's gone.
No, he's coming. I think he's there. I'll see if he wants to.
Is your hand that could be straight? Absolutely. I hope so. What you're talking about for a second. Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I wondered if you might be able to sign the book.
Sure.
Is that all right? I don't have a pen.
I don't. Do I have one? Hi there. Hi. Oh, hello. Hi. Hi there. How are you?
Good. Yeah. The guy said that I could talk.
By all means.
Oh yeah.
Sure.
I think. Yeah. I was just.
Does anybody have a pen so that I could sign this young lady's book?
Oh, I've only got a biro.
A biro? Okay.
I might have a felt tip, though. I've got one.
Is this yellow, or is it... purple is good. Okay, what is your name?
Chloe.
What is today? November 19th?
Yes. Yeah, good.
Okay, there you go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes. How long are you in Glasgow for?
Another couple of days. And then I'm, yeah. Were you asking, could the book be enjoyed if you were straight?
I suppose it was, I think it was a response.
Because the answer is yes.
It's more like, kind of had the questions from the guy, and I felt like they kind of were veering towards like going away from some of the things that I thought were like some of the most active, like things going up, like, yeah, like especially the length of it, and almost like the duration of it, like 75 years and 800 pages, but still having so much room for like when you're reading out that part, it's all the conversation, and it's such a like pace to it, and it's such a like pace of a life. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a book about a life. It's a book about it's about several lives. It's about several lives and how they intertwine. Yeah. And in that sense, I suppose it has an epic quality.
And also just like how it feels completely new. Like I think that's for me like the really like almost kind of like the radical kind of thesis of it, that to mix all the other things with these parts that are so like. Okay.
Have you read it?
Yeah.
Okay, because I'm not sure. Like, okay, so you've read it. Okay.
Huh?
What? I did not hear every other phrase.
That's been such a like full-on experience. Like, it almost feels like so immersive because of that. And
yeah.
I just kind of imagine that not being there. And I suppose like Linda asked, it kind of splits the audience a bit. Like what you experience from it, so different.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, it's a book for people. It's a book for people who get off on every page.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a book for people who don't. I mean, the people who don't get off on that stuff are going to have a very different response.
Yeah.
You know, but hopefully they will still realize that the sex is accurate.
Yeah.
You know, and that there are people who are interested in stuff for that.
Who did you intend it for?
I intended it for a gay audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was not written for a straight audience. It was specifically not. I mean, which is now I wanted. I was not. It was not written to exclude a straight audience.
Yeah.
It was written so that I thought, you know, I thought it's not going to hurt straight people if somebody who actually wants to get through it. To know that this is the way some people do live, you know, and so you know, and I, and sex was a large part of my childhood. You know, when I say childhood, I mean childhood up until the age of 40 and 50 and 60. You know,
takes a lot of pressure off.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No. I didn't recognize it was you. I mean, I didn't. I mean, you're up there in the back. I didn't know. And only when you came down did I know who. If I had known who it was, and the fact that we'd actually talked before, it would have been a very different. I would have had a very different response, because as I said, I wasn't.
Well, I feel like even when I emailed you, the questions were kind of still similar. It's like rah 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 rah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember your response was like, I don't really get the question,
So, but anyway, hey, you know, but thank you for responding to it, you know, and as I said, and I mean, things I couldn't tell whether you had read it or not, and nor could I tell. Where you were going with it? Now I can now. As soon as I saw you, it just there was a different context.
I was going to be quite cheeky and just like, think I might be one of the people that read the book, because I felt like in the audience there was this thing of like, so you said this thing about like sci-fi, and it's like, I feel like if you read it, you would, a lot of the questions were like answered in the work.
I think most of the, in a situation like this, most of the questions are answered by the book itself, you know.
It's a pleasure
meeting you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure meeting you. Mm-hmm.
So nice to
okay, and good to, you. Good to see, good to see you again. Yeah, and you. Soldier on. And I, it's enough to make me want to write another book for you.
Okay.
All right. I had no idea that's who it was.
I couldn't see either. I couldn't see because of the
I mean, we talked.
He was at the hangout, the meeting yesterday.
Yeah, and we talked, and we talked, and we talked a fair amount yesterday. Okay, and your name is?
My name's Nicole. N-I-C-O-L-E.
N-I-C-O-L-E.
You were talking about stars in their pockets, like grains of sand.
I teach at University of Dundee. I teach stars in my pocket there.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And we named a prize after you.
Really?
We emailed you.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes, and thank you for very much. I was,
what's the prize?
It's for interdisciplinary.
Uh-huh.
It's what?
For interdisciplinary in English studies.
Okay, yeah,
for
uh-huh.
Writing or for...
Well, because of the degree structure, uh-huh. We've students who take other courses besides uh-huh. English, if they have really high marks, they can get a prize, but uh-huh. they get other courses.
Oh, I see. So now they get
thank
the Samuel
you.
R. Delaney prize.
They do.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah.
That's really
and
great.
To reward that interdisciplinary.
Well, thank you.
Do you want me to take a picture of you with Chip and you can show it for your prize giving?
Would you mind?
Not at all, not at all.
Have you got a camera or something? Or otherwise I'll have to email it to you.
Chip, I wouldn't mind, that'd be great, yes.
Yeah, I'll get your email address.
Let me take your mic. Where did you put it?
Where did I put it? It's in here.
I did put it in there, yeah.
I'll see you by the way.
Yeah. How's that?
Fine.
Perfect.
Hand over your phone. Right, come on then, let's get a big...
Thank you.